This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In a bit, we'll talk about an unusual sort of phone that could soon be coming to a store near you.
Yeah, it's a phone you can talk on without using your ear. So if you slap it on your forehead, you'll be able to hear the audio coming through.
First up, the state budget has been officially signed into law. Governor Walker came out with his vetoes yesterday, and while most of the budget got his thumbs up, there were a few adjustments that are making headlines today.
Joining us to talk about those changes and how they might affect you is J.R. Ross. He's the editor at WisPolitics.com. J.R., welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
So, you know, say what you will, think what you will about this budget, it was on time.
Yes, absolutely. We've gotten much better about that in the last few years in Wisconsin compared to the old days. I think 6 years ago, we were still debating it in October, so it's gotten much better since then.
What do you attribute that to?
In 2009, Democrats had control of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office. Then you had the reverse in 11 and 13 with Republicans control of everything. So even if there are disagreements between the legislature and the governor in those scenarios, it's on the same page, at least in the same chapter of the book. So it makes it much easier to get something done when you're all from the same party.
So agreeing on stuff helps.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I want to start with the reversal on the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Now, a provision in the original budget proposal would have kicked that center off the UW campus and also prevented them from collaborating with university staff. Now, there was a turnaround there with the veto.
Yeah, absolutely. We're still not sure exactly what the motivation was by Republican lawmakers and the Joint Finance Committee from inserting that into the budget. There was some history between the center and John Nygren Marinette, who's the co-chair of that committee from the Assembly, but nobody really kind of came forward and took ownership of it. There was, though, an argument from Republicans that as a media organization, it shouldn't be getting there for a state subsidy to operate, essentially. But, you know, the governor, in vetoing this provision out, said that, you know, basically not the right place to do this. He objected to it and basically also made a note, though, to the university that he wants them to go look at all these relationships with any kind of think tank or organization, whatever, and develop a policy for everybody. So we're not dealing with, you know, singling somebody out, for example, in the future kind of thing. So also there's a little bit of a nice benefit for the governor here. This veto, which is, or this provision, I'm sorry, which was put in the budget, you know, in kind of the 4:30, 5 o'clock hour after an all-night session, got a lot of kind of public condemnation from various media outlets. The governor probably see a nice, you know, some kudos and various editorials now for doing this. So it's a nice little bump for him also politically to have done this.
But he does have that, as you said, that that kernel in there that the UW needs to look and make a policy, which could come back, I suppose, down the road.
Yeah, it depends. You know, and that's the question. What does the Board of Regents want to have a relationship with these kinds of outfits? Now, the center, for example, it trains students, it, you know, offers them, you know, hands-on training, if you will, to kind of prepare them for the real world. Is that something they want to see? Is there, what kind of benefit should students get or the faculty get from having these kinds of relationships? Those are the things that I think he wants them to study going forward.
Now, moving on, Walker also vetoed an item that would have allowed for-profit bail bondsmen to operate in Wisconsin for the first time since something like 1979.
Yep.
And this was something that was originally added by the Joint Finance Committee during that all-night session you mentioned also. So why does the Joint Finance Committee want bail bondsmen in Wisconsin, and why do you think the governor went the other way?
Well, a little history. Lawmakers also put a similar provision in the budget 2 years ago, and the governor vetoed that out. This one was somewhat different than the first one. It would have started as a pilot program in five counties, including Dane County, operated for 5 years and gone statewide. It also would have given judges the discretion, if you will, to allow bail bonds in the cases before them. So with that history in mind, there's a kind of a mindset among some Republicans that, look, if it's a legal industry, we should be allowed to operate in Wisconsin. Same goes for things like rent-to-own and petty lenders, which they have their detractors who think that they are unseemly businesses. But for these lawmakers, they say, look, you know, it's legal. We should have it here. And that's kind of part of the prevailing thought. The governor, though, vetoed this, was urged to by all kinds of people in the legal community, by Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. There's really no call, if you will, for this to come back from, you know, attorneys, judges, prosecutors. It really wasn't something people were pushing for. So it was kind of an easy veto for some ways that the legal community didn't want it. There was some thought after they put this in the budget a couple weeks ago that because it was a pilot program in those five counties, because it was softened, if you will, from last time, that he'd be more open to signing it. And from what I can tell from my sources, he kind of wavered back and forth about this a little bit last week up until kind of the last minute, and then decided that, no, he had an issue with the policy and it being in the budget in general.
And as I understand it, though, the door was left a little bit ajar on that one, right?
Well, you know, there's always the argument that if you do it in a separate bill, not in the budget, then they'd be more open to it. Because, I mean, this is kind of part of the sausage-making process, if you will, with a budget. While it dictates taxes and spending and all these kind of financial things, lawmakers from both parties historically have always kind of crammed it up with all kinds of policy items. And so there is part of it is a bias against doing that kind of policy in the budget. Make it a standalone bill, you know, have it stand on its own merits, if you will, rather than having it passed because it's jammed in with all kinds of other things people like. They have to accept it to get what they like. Now, if it were a separate bill, though, there's a huge question if it would pass both houses of the legislature, especially in the state Senate. From what I kind of heard through the course of the process, that House is a little less enthusiastic, if you will, about the bailabouts revision than the Assembly was.
And let's close now with the tweaks to the school voucher program. What's different there?
Well, there was this concern right after the budget was done by lawmakers that, for example, we have these caps right now that the governor signed yesterday on school choice, the expansion statewide. So Milwaukee and Racine are separate. You know, we've had those. Milwaukee's been operating for 20-some years, and Racine was approved in the last budget. But they put caps, you know, statewide of 500 kids in the first year of the budget and 1,000 in the second. There was a fear from the Department of Public Instruction on two things. One, that a school in Milwaukee or Racine could establish a charter or a satellite school, I should say, anywhere in the state, bring in students that way, and those students would not count toward those caps. The governor's office felt that wasn't really a concern because they argued that public instruction, the Department of Public Instruction, or Tony Evers, had the authority to stop that from happening. But they were concerned about this other provision in there that they felt like if you were, for example, look over Milwaukee, if you were a student in Waukesha, for example, you could go from Waukesha Public Schools into the Milwaukee Choice Program and not count toward that cap, that 500 and 1,000. So they vetoed the language on that to make sure that the caps that he agreed to with lawmakers reflect the intent when they first sat down and did this, you know, last month. So that is still in place, make sure we'll have real caps of 500 and 1,000 students statewide outside of Milwaukee and Racine.
So 57 some vetoes or so. We looked at a few of them there. And thank you so much, JR, for joining us today.
Anytime. Have a good day.
You too. And that was J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. And we've got a link to his reporting on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll talk about what it's like to use a soft tissue phone and what it means to be a soft tissue phone and when it might be coming to stores near us. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
So we still can't have a picnic on the moon or have our smartphones embedded into our brains via a microchip, but there is some cool new stuff coming down the pike.
Yeah, we're going to check on the latest technology from time to time here on Central Time. Right now, we're going to look at this new phone. The brand name is the Kyocera Torque Phone.
Our friends over at Discover Magazine in Waukesha got to test the Torque Phone, and associate editor Gemma Tarlak joins us now to tell us about it. Hi, Gemma.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
So this Torque Phone, what is it exactly?
Okay. Well, for the more tech-inclined folks out there, it's a 4G Android smartphone, and it's the first sold in the United States that uses soft tissue conduction technology, which I'll talk about in a moment, but I think the whole thing to know about the Torque is that it's geared towards either very adventurous people or very clumsy people because it's all about, it's waterproof, dustproof. It's also, you know, you go on YouTube and you see people freezing it in blocks of ice, putting it through the washing machine, seeing what they can do with it. And the soft tissue conduction is a big deal because if you're standing on the top of the mountain in a windstorm, as you might be if you're the Torque kind of person, you'll still be able to hear. And it's kind of a fascinating new technology that actually developed from hearing aids.
And let's talk about what it means to be a soft tissue phone. Usually we hold a phone up. I would hold a phone up to my ear, and sound waves come out and vibrate those little bits in the ear. What's different about soft tissue technology?
Well, as you know, with a phone or with any other sound, really, the sound waves vibrate through the air through your ear canal and hit your eardrum. With tissue conduction, like in the TORQ, you actually hold the screen so it's touching your ear, and that allows vibrations sent out through the screen to travel through the soft tissue in your head. So in your ear, and you know, some of the crazy tests we did when they sent us a loaner phone were holding the screen to the tip of my nose or to my forehead or even to the back of my neck. And as you can imagine, we got some looks from people walking by, but I was able to have a conversation with the phone pressed to my nose, which was a very disorienting sensation, but still kind of cool.
I was just going to ask you, was there a slight freak-out factor as you use this phone because it's so counter to how we're used to using cell phones?
You know, there is, and it feels a little bit creepy because even though I'm holding the phone to my nose and I can feel it pressed against my nose, I still hear it in my ear. And so it's kind of like the voices in my head are really there. And it was a little disorienting. But the other great thing about it is that you can hear with other ambient noise around. When the sound waves from a regular phone travel through the air, through the ear canal, in addition to those sound waves from the phone, you're getting all the ambient noise, the fan in the room, the screaming baby, et cetera, et cetera. But with this phone, because the vibrations are traveling through the soft tissue, you get a little bit of ambient noise through the ear canal, but you're still getting all the good stuff coming through your tissue. So that does sound creepy when I say it. Even though I've used it and like it, I still think, oh, that sounds creepy when I say it. But the great news is, for example, one of the other tests we performed was I had the phone to one ear, and then the other ear I was blowing a hairdryer. And even though there was all the ambient noise of a hairdryer, I could still have a phone conversation, which again is kind of bizarre and crazy, but what a boon to someone with a barking dog or a screaming child.
Now, on the creepiness factor, I mean, this is working, right, by vibrating pretty much everything in your head that isn't bone. Do I have that right?
And actually, the bone is involved too.
Oh, it is.
Tissue conduction. And you know, there are some products out there that use bone conduction. There are some headphones out there, and also it's rumored that the much anticipated Google Glass is going to use bone conduction technology. But the thing with soft tissue conduction is that in addition to traveling through the bone, it also travels through the cartilage and other. So it's supposed to provide greater clarity.
So
it's traveling through more stuff in your skull.
But does it feel like the stuff in your skull is vibrating weirdly?
No, you don't feel it. And I think in a way, if I did feel parts of my skull vibrating, it would kind of make more sense. But it's just, you know, holding the phone to my nose and hearing it in my ear. And that's just kind of, whoa, what's going on? And also, you can hold it to the top of your head as well, unless you have a lot of hair. And then that causes distortion.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but you know how there are these perennial concerns about the safety of cell phones. And people are already upset and concerned that if they use their cell phones and press it to their ear, that they'll be sending, you know, radiation, what have you, to their brains. Is this, you know, going to set off people's alarm bells even more, knowing that it's vibrating through even more tissue and cartilage and bone?
Oh, come on. Vibrating through your skull? What could possibly go wrong? But in all seriousness, this technology began with hearing aids. This is an innovation in the hearing aid technology, and while I don't have the specific studies in front of me, it's gone through a lot of rigorous review and study. And, you know, is it going to be any better or worse than a normal cell phone in that respect? I don't think so, and I certainly haven't seen anything that would suggest there's an elevated risk compared with a normal cell phone.
You mentioned that there are other products on the market that are bone conduction.
Yeah.
So talk about those, and have you tried them ever?
I have not, sadly, despite my begging for it. Google will not send me a Google Glass. I'm not a Google Glass pioneer. But there are a few products out there and more coming down the pipeline with bone conduction. But it pretty much works in the same way. The sound clarity is apparently not as good because there's not as much vibration able to pass through as there is with tissue conduction.
So any idea what the price on this puppy is, considering it sounds like it's pretty indestructible?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a range of prices out there depending on, you know, whether you buy it from a reputable dealer or the guy on the corner, but it runs about $100 and that's with a rebate. So it's certainly, you know, sort of in the mid-range for a smartphone, and I was intrigued when I saw the first press releases for it way back when it was the trade shows in January and February, because I'm a very clumsy person, and I also listen to way too much heavy metal as a youth. So the idea that I could actually hear a phone conversation was very appealing to me.
Yeah, I think I need one, actually. Once you said indestructible, it's a running joke around here that my iPhone is on the ground more often than it's in my hand.
And, you know, I'm holding, actually, the loaner they sent me right now. And it's about the same size as a smartphone, a little bit heavier. It's about 6 ounces. And it has, I think it looks kind of cool. It has a sort of rugged outer case that makes you feel like you should be climbing a mountain or doing something extreme.
Well, let's look at the future of this kind of technology. Mm-hmm. It's in one kind of phone now. We are using headphones, of course, at a radio station. Are we going to see the stuff in our skull being vibrated by a headphone in the near future?
Absolutely. In fact, Panasonic, I believe, is coming out with, hopefully by the end of this year, just in time for the holidays, they're coming out with bone conduction headphones. And as I mentioned, Google Glass reportedly, while they won't confirm it, it's pretty certain that they are using bone conduction technology. Will we see more tissue conduction? I think absolutely. When you look at the reception that the Torque is getting, a lot of people are very excited about it. I think it's just natural that more companies are going to go in this direction for development of products.
Our board operator, Michelle Good, keeps shaking her head in dismay every time you say bone conduction or soft tissue conduction. I'm wondering, I don't know, I think a lot of people, Veronica mentioned earlier, but a lot of people may just hear these phrases and say, no thanks, I'm good with old-fashioned sound waves.
And you know, if you enjoy having sound travel through the air as it has done for millennia, I think that's fine. But again, I think, you know, definitely people who find themselves in noisy situations or people who rocked out way too much to Metallica, guilty, they will appreciate this. And it is kind of a neat technology. Once you get used to hearing the voices in your head, it is a very neat technology.
Now, I assume it works if you just hold it up to your ear as well, right? Same principle?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. They didn't design it so people would walk around with a phone on their
nose. You don't have to look like a weirdo. You can use it like a phone. So that's something.
Yes, in fact, most people will just hold it to their ear. We were kind of pushing the technology and seeing how far we could get it. And, you know, we even tried it on our elbows and whatnot. But once it gets that far from the actual ear, first of all, it's hard for the person I'm talking to hear me because, you know, I've got the phone stuck to my elbow. So it works best if you keep it attached to part of your head.
So maybe as the technology gets better, we could just have it in our pocket or something. But then, of course, we wouldn't be able to talk. So maybe I'm solving a problem that is creating more problems.
Well, you know, I think we can all laugh about it, but I think it's only a matter of time before we start getting things implanted in our heads and are permanently on. So
I don't know if I want to have a conversation with a phone in my back pocket. It just doesn't sound good for anyone, frankly. Gemma, where do you see this, you know, the next iteration of phone coming from? Is it this Torque phone, or is there another angle that they're going to be playing soon?
Well, I think there are so many different aspects of the phone, whether you're talking about the software involved, the apps involved, but in terms of the actual construction, the hardware of the phone, I think you're going to see more tissue conduction. I think you're going to see more emphasis on durability. I think everyone's a little bit tired of dropping their phones and having the screens crack or whatnot. And I'm not saying the Torque is going to be, you know, it's the leader that all the others will follow, but I think it has a lot of features that are proving very popular. And obviously, companies are always looking to see what is popular among the competition. So I think we'll see more of those features incorporated more broadly.
Gemma, thank you so much for talking about this today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That was Gemma Tarlak. She's associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we're going to talk about internet addiction.
Our guest is going to be telling us when heavy internet use crosses that line and actually becomes a problem, something you have to look at, something you have to treat, and when it affects maybe your family life as well, and you know what we can do about it.
Maybe we'll have like computers that can vibrate the internet into our heads down the road. I don't think I like where that's going.
I don't either. I think you better stay out of the product development arena, Rob.
It's weird. I've never been asked to be part of it in the first place.
That's odd. I don't understand that.
And then also tomorrow we're going to talk about bike safety in Wisconsin, how bikes, cars, and pedestrians can live together in relative peace and harmony.
And we've got an interesting thing going with Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss. He's helping us name our new segment. It will either be Nerd Up or Geek Out. You can chime in with your vote on the Central Time Facebook page. And that's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up, our guest makes the case for why we should value the arts and how much they're actually worth to the economy. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll check in now on the latest news from Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
A few months ago, the Bureau of Economic Analysis announced that it will include spending on the arts in its analysis of U.S. economic growth. And that got us thinking, what is the value of the arts?
Yeah, how do you calculate how much a masterpiece is worth, or a play, or an art fair?
And we want to hear from you on this. How much do you value the arts? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@WPR.org to let us know what you think.
To help us figure out the economic value of the arts, we've recruited Randy Cohen. He's Vice President of Research and Policy for Americans for the Arts. Randy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now, I know you've been keeping an eye on us here in Wisconsin. How does arts funding look in our state?
Well, I think it's certainly been challenged in Wisconsin compared to a lot of other states. Most people don't understand sort of the funding ecology for the arts, even, you know, why is the state or why are city and county governments involved in funding of the arts? And, we love the arts. They improve our quality of life, and really they create the communities that we want to live in. But to make them accessible to the public, they really look to both public and private sector, you know, so government and businesses, to help keep those costs down, to keep the arts accessible to, you know, everybody in the community. But it's interesting, even, I think a lot of people are just thinking, well, I never really thought about the arts economically. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought about them as something that inspires me and delights and entertains, and they certainly do all of that. But the fact is, statewide in Wisconsin, nonprofit arts organizations, so just, you know, your theaters, your museums, your ballet companies, those organizations alone spend $340 million a year, every year. And arts organizations are good business citizens. So that's why we really try to track and count what they're doing. They employ people locally. They purchase goods and services in the community. But then they have a real value-added aspect to their communities as well. And so I just invite everybody, think about the last time you went out to, you know, see the theater or an evening arts event. Well, you know, you probably got in the car and drove, and on the way there stopped and had dinner and maybe went out for dessert or drinks after the show. And if you got little ones at home, you know, you double the cost of the evening on babysitting, right? So if you add up all that, that's $195 million in event-related spending just in Wisconsin. So, you know, you've got a lot of economic activity, $535 million of economic activity that supports almost 23,000 jobs just in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, when I think about the economy and what economists measure, it seems complicated but fairly straightforward to say, hey, this factory had this economic impact and this type of retail store, say, had this economic impact. How do we measure, how do we gauge the impact of these arts institutions that you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's certainly, if you're looking for, economic analysis measures, you look at how much those arts organizations are spending and what they're spending it on, and then what's the economic impact of that spending. So For example, you know, we've got this, you know, these numbers statewide, but just say, look at, you know, the Madison area as well. You know, just one community, $145 million of economic activity. That supports over 5,000 jobs, just about a little over 5,100 jobs right there in Madison, and generates $13.8 million in revenue to the local and state government. So, you know, government is making these investments, but they're seeing a pretty good return on that investment as well. So, you know, economists look at, you know, at things, you know, through those kinds of lenses. Now, one of the interesting things is in sort of, you know, tourism impact and, you know, how the arts are moving people around is another thing that we track. And, you know, just maybe switching over to the Milwaukee area just for variation, you know, about 4.5 million arts attendees to arts events every year. 22% of them come from outside the Milwaukee area to attend those arts events. So people are traveling, and the arts are really helping to drive tourism. And every time somebody goes out to an arts event, you know, statewide in Wisconsin, they spend $19.06 per person per event beyond the cost of admission. So lots of economic activity related to that arts event. So, you know, those are many of the lenses. You know, sometimes if you've seen the recent Time magazine, I think it was last week, you know, they were sort of looking at measuring happiness. You know, those are other aspects that economists are starting to gauge. And, you know, we haven't quite been able to figure out how to put a number on that related to the arts. But I think that's what people sort of assume with the arts. Wow, yeah, they, you know, they improve our quality of life. They make these communities that we want to live in. But they provide both cultural and economic benefits.
Well, you mentioned public investment in the arts just a minute ago, and that's kind of the tricky bit because the arts aren't in a vacuum. Money that is being spent on the arts isn't going into, say, a tax cut or bringing in a manufacturing industry or a zillion other things in, say, the state budget that was just passed. How do you make the case that arts deserve that kind of investment given what they're stacked up against?
Well, you know, we talk about it a couple of ways. Number one, just plain economic impact. And, you know, very few other industries generate the kind of that event-related spending that the arts do. And so, you know, you've got this economic activity of the arts organization, but then there's all this event-related spending. You know, just sort of going back to, you know, the Madison area, you know, 24% of the attendees come from outside of Madison. Two-thirds of those folks say, we came here for this arts event. You know, and those people spend over $40 per person per event. So, you know, if you're a local merchant, you're seeing the economic benefits that this arts event is leveraging. But, you know, if we sort of broaden the lens, you know, we can look at the impact of the arts on education. You know, here's an issue we're all worrying about in Wisconsin as well as the other 49 states in the country. Well, some really powerful research that shows when the arts are part of our education system, our young people's education, they are performing better academically. You know, we're seeing higher grade point averages, higher standardized test scores, lower dropout rates, and those are findings that cut across all socioeconomic strata. So this isn't just a phenomenon of, you know, better educated, more affluent families. Even low-income neighborhoods and Title I schools see the benefit of a vibrant arts community. And so again, here now you're providing this skilled, educated workforce that our business leaders are looking for.
You know, I got to say, coming into this conversation and asking the questions I'm asking, I feel like a bit of a kind of a Philistine, like, let's put economic values, numbers on all the paintings and art that we're doing. Is it hard to get people thinking that way, putting a number on the impact of art?
You know, it's not hard once you start talking about it, but you're right. It's not intuitive. We don't really think about, you know, that's not the first thing we think about when we think of the arts. But the fact is, you know, when we ask, you know, government to make an investment in the arts, essentially, you know, we also want to know, hey, what are the people getting in return? What's the community get? What's the ROI on that? And it's a totally appropriate question to ask anytime the government makes an investment. And so here you're getting both really improving the fundamental quality of life and really fueling our you know, our humanity, you know, it's food for the soul, and you're also getting these economic benefits. You know, that investment's not a black hole. It doesn't just disappear into a swirl of goodness. It's a wonderful thing, and it's supporting jobs and generating government revenue, and it's driving tourism.
We're talking to Randy Cohen. We're in the midst of a swirl of goodness. He's with the Americans for the Arts, and we're talking about the economic value of the arts. We want to hear from you on this topic. Do you think things like theater, art museums, art fairs are valuable economically? And why? What value do you assign to a great film or a ballet? Do you want to see more public support for the arts, or do you not want to see that? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We'll continue our conversation about the value of the arts after this. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Kathleen Dunn Show, Kathleen will talk to a guest about the program Hours Against Hate. It's a U.S. State Department campaign to stop bigotry and promote respect across the lines of culture, religion, gender, and sexual orientation. That's tomorrow after 2 on The Kathleen Dunn Show.
Right now, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst of the WPR News Department.
Egypt's military is giving the country's president and his opponents 2 days to reach an agreement. It's warning that it will intervene unless Islamist President Mohamed Morsi meets what it calls the people's demands. For a second day, hundreds of thousands of protesters have gathered in Cairo and elsewhere, calling on Morsi to step down. For the first 6 months of the year, Chicago police say the city has seen 184 homicides. And while that may be a lot for some cities, it represents a significant drop for Chicago when compared to last year. It's down by 29% from the 260 homicides seen during the first 6 months of 2012. The League of Women Voters wants the Wisconsin Supreme Court to review an appellate decision that found the state's voter photo identification law is constitutional. The league's attorneys filed a petition on Friday asking the court to take the case. 3 of the court's 7 justices must vote to accept it. It's unclear when that vote might happen.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the value of the arts now with Randy Cohen from Americans for the Arts, and we're taking your calls now. Do you think the arts have value? How do you assign that value? Are they worth public investment from the state or local governments or not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, send an email to talk@wpr.org, or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. We'll go to the phones now. We have PJ in Waupun. PJ, hi.
Hi. Thank you for the show. It's excellent.
Thanks. What are you thinking about with the arts?
I think the arts are so valuable. Either you like doing art or you like spending your free time and your money on art. It is your cars, it's your clothes, it's your phone design, it's your apps. It is every aspect of your life, even the money in your wallet. So I just love the show, and I teach art, and that's what I teach my kids, and they teach creative thinking and problem-solving skills. And I just can't say enough about your show, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling, PJ. Randy, no argument there, I'm guessing.
No, that's thank you, and thanks for teaching and being such a, you know, building the future, PJ. You know, one of the interesting things is if you look at the business community and organizations like the Conference Board, you know, which is the organization with the serving the Fortune 1000 companies in this country, their research shows that creativity has soared to the top 5 applied skills that business leaders are looking for. You know, business leaders who run these companies, they're looking to attract a skilled, educated, creative workforce, because that's the key to prospering in this global economy and really driving innovation. And if you look at what they consider our business leaders, the top indicators of creativity, it's starting your own business and it's study of the arts, especially while in college. So even the business community is connecting, you know, the arts to creativity and innovation.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Jay, who just dropped off the line in Madison. Well, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that arts, things like theaters, museums, are good business neighbors, good community members. Could you talk about their role as kind of community centers and centers for the business in an area?
Well, absolutely. You know, the arts, you know, you see cultural districts or, you know, when you've got theaters, museums, and, you know, they really bring people to a downtown and enliven and animate a downtown. And people come, they pay for parking, and they see their show, or they go to their exhibit, and they may stay and have a meal or have dessert and walk around, do some retail shopping. Those are really help drive tourism and bring people to the communities. So, you know, smart growth investment includes these energetic hubs, you know, in our communities, and the arts really are a core part of that. And then it's just good industry as well. You know, looking nationally, we can't look at really statewide, but the arts are a huge export industry. Our exports in this country of arts, you know, which would be paintings, movies, jewelry, $72 billion. And we only imported $25 billion, a $47 billion trade surplus, just the arts. So again, we think of it maybe as sometimes people think, you know, oh, it's this drain or we're spending all this money. Well, in fact, you know, it's just proving to be a good economic choice.
Can you point out any communities that didn't have a lot in the way of an art community and became a success story?
Yes. Well, there's, yeah, I mean, you've got great, arts communities in Wisconsin, you know, Milwaukee, you know, over the years is a city that's invested, you know, heavily and really drawn people from the region. But even, you know, La Crosse and Eau Claire, you know, a whole range of communities, you know, and it's who've just made these conscious choices that, you know, we're going to have this arts community. We're going to use them to attract people here. You know, I'm reminded of Upjohn there up in Kalamazoo years ago was trying to think, how do we compete for, you know, all these knowledge workers, and because now you could do your biotech stuff in Miami Beach or on the coast of California. Well, one of the things they did is they built a big arts center there because they knew that was one of the keys to attracting not just the workers, but the workers' families. And even Chicago is, you know, the big cities are paying attention to this as well. Boeing recently relocated its headquarters to Chicago. Well, Governor Perry down in Texas is out in the open, public speeches now saying the reason the Dallas-Fort Worth area lost the Boeing headquarters to Chicago is they couldn't compete culturally. They knew this was critical to Boeing, to attracting their executives and their families.
Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Talk about your community with us. Are you in a town in Wisconsin or a city in Wisconsin that the arts are an important part of? Or that you think are missing and you'd like to see more, call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We've got Stephen in the line now in Madison. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to speak briefly to what your guest was saying about sort of the importance of the arts and these civic projects to education. I teach creative writing at UW-Madison, and a lot of the kids come from rural areas where they haven't necessarily seen readings, you know, and seen the authors performing their works. And just these sort of civic projects provide opportunities for us, teaching opportunities for us to sort of introduce them and to these writers and let them see the process and the artists behind the works that they assume, you know, are kind of you know, written a long time ago or in a place far away, and it kind of makes it real for them, and it kind of sort of bridges this and engenders this sort of lifelong understanding that there are creators behind these works, and that you know, that these are sort of important things that are alive and well and not just a part of the past and not just a part of curriculum.
Stephen, thank you so much for the call. Randy, the personal encounter with the arts that he's talking about.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is if you look at the numbers, personal creation, people writing, people singing, people taking ceramics classes, look at the most popular shows on TV. They're all about these days personal creation, a performance in the arts. And, you know, America Can Dance, all these shows. Well, there's a growth in the number of dance schools nationally going on in this country. So there is a lot of interest, I think, in people having that personal active engagement in the arts. And savvy arts organizations are figuring that out. It's not just the, yeah, we do our show at 8 o'clock and kick everybody out the front door. These arts organizations are looking how to more actively engage folks in the process. And people want to know, wow, how are they doing that? And what goes on? And it really, when you see the backstage or the rehearsals or you see the writing process, I love what Stephen's describing, you know, you really appreciate so much more what goes into the creation.
Stephen, thanks so much for the call. We have Joe now in Star Lake. Hi there, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm an artist myself, musician, a writer, a storyteller. I live on the West Coast, but I come back every summer and with my wife, and we spend the summers here in Wisconsin. And there's an idea I've had for some time, which one of the big movements around the country is the CSA, which is community-supported agriculture. And it started because a lot of farms were going out of production, and because farmers didn't, they weren't sure they could survive. So the community makes a commitment beforehand. They're going to buy so many vegetables and so forth. They get so many clients. And it's really become quite a powerful movement, and it's saved a lot of land. And I think from an artist's point of view, and speaking as a working artist, I think we should have community-supported arts where there's a commitment made beforehand for artists to come into community, not just a tax break, but somehow or another that some of their artwork, through some process, once they're, you know, it's been decided that they're sort of in this this plan, and some of that artwork would go directly to individuals, but also could be public art that has created a certain amount of art. The other side of it, and I'll finish this idea that I think is important, is the artists also make a commitment to that community. So if for some reason, they write the great novel or create the great, they become the new sculptor, you know, flavor of the month nationally, they don't move out of the community. They've made the same commitment that they are going to be rooted in that community. But the community is also giving them a commitment so they know they can survive.
Joe, thanks a lot. That's an interesting idea, Randy. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a great idea. An artist connected to community is, I think it's natural, and it goes back, you know, to our earliest cave days, really. So, you know, it was just 2 years ago, some anthropologists found this hand-carved flute, and it's 25,000-year-old in a cave, you know. So, I mean, really, I mean, that's sort of taking it to the extreme. But just as an example, I tell you, of how the artist can engage and connect in the community. I used to work in medical research and in hospitals, and patients that I used to see at this one hospital, they had live chamber music in the lobby every day, every Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And patients that you would see clinically who were sort of lethargic, depressed, in the presence of the music, you could just see physical transformation take place. Eyes got less cloudy, posture got better, better engagement with the environment around them. And there's this growing body of research now that shows when the arts are part of our health care and healing, which is certainly an important part of and growing part of our communities, people are healing faster, taking less medication. And of course, you know, the Greeks knew this, right? The god Apollo is the god of both music and healing. You know, so you talk about a big portfolio, that guy had it. But so the arts really can be integrated into many different aspects of our community, and I like Joe's strategy as a way to do it.
Randy, you've talked a lot about the benefits of the arts for communities. Do you think people are buying what you're selling, or is this idea catching on?
Oh, I think people do. You know, people just, it's just increasing their awareness of what the arts do and how they inspire us and delight us as individuals and how they're also good for the community. And, you know, for the skeptics, we just point to the research, you know, and it comes from economists or it comes from education academics. And so a lot of people have looked to see how these, you know, how a vibrant arts community are helping us build healthier communities. So it's a great story.
And what's the last art thing you've gone out to, Randy? What are you a fan of?
Oh, well, I love the theater, you know, and I love to get out whenever possible. So I think it was, well, probably last month or something. So on a date with my wife, and we went out, saw the theater. We paid $10 for parking. We, you know, had a $60 dinner. So it was a really fantastic evening. And it was a wonderful arts event, which we talked about that evening and really for the next part of the week, you know, as we kept talking about that theater. And so it was something that really gave us a wonderful shared experience. And it was, you know, really built a whole evening around it. So it was It was just a wonderful time. So,
and when you're actually sitting there watching the play, can you turn off the dollar signs associated with it and just enjoy it and not think about what percentage of this line is going into the community?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's so easy to get swept away. That's the beauty of the arts, you know. But
all right. Randy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
That was Randy Cohen. He's Vice President of Research and Policy for Americans for the Arts.
Stick around. There's much more to come on Central Time, including the latest on protest in Egypt and an ultimatum from the Egyptian military for the government and protesters to work out a deal. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time, our first full week of Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around. We've got the news coming up next.